The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, David deals with massive ship and cleans it up. Roger does diligence and diligence does him back. Jennifer gets full-time at consulting rates. Another pitch strikes, we'll see. More fraud, spies, and lies, and a whole lot more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Tuesday, July 18th, go to Angel, present your company, get on the show, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details, or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co. This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Welcome, Kyle. Tell us what your company is and what do you do?
Sure. We're a comprehensive disease-specific virtual care management platform that does remote patient monitoring, medical nutrition.
All right. Hang on. Way too complicated. So let's try and parse that out. What do you do?
We provide virtual care management technology and...
Wait. What is virtual care?
Virtual care is care from the comfort of the patient's home, office, wherever they are from the palm of their hand.
Okay, so when you say virtual, it's over usually a cell phone or some device, right? It's over the internet. All right, so what's the management part of what you do?
So we manage biometrics, so vitals, medication compliance, nutrition, care coordination.
All right, so everything having to do with patient care, is that right?
Right.
Now, that's if they're at home or somewhere like that. It's not if they're in the hospital, right?
Correct.
All right. So how exactly does this work? Instead of going to the doctor's office, if you have the need for it, the doctor does what? What does the doctor give you to allow you to have their care be virtual?
Their patient data and the information that we need to deliver the service. So it's their demographics, their insurance information, and the diagnoses of the chronic issues they're dealing with.
That's the doctor giving it to you, your company, right?
Mm-hmm.
What goes to the patient? What does the patient get in order to have that kind of care instead of in-office care?
If they have a smart device, they download our app. If they don't have a smart device, this can all be done through the phone. They get a dedicated health navigator and care team. And they're tracking any vitals. We provide them with a device that has a cellular internet built into it so we can drive compliance and make it easier for them.
All right. So when you say you give them a device, so if they need a heart monitor, you have a heart monitor or you have a device that attaches to a heart monitor? How does that work?
We integrate with over 250 devices that are FDA approved.
Okay. So when you say you integrate with them, my understanding is if you're going to connect a medical device to the internet, there are new regulations that just came out that require some security precautions and so forth. So do you provide the security for the medical devices you connect to, or how does that work?
They're HIPAA compliant, level 2 high trust.
Okay, none of that has to do with the FDA requirement. The FDA requirement is a new requirement that has to do with any device attached to the internet. And they don't tell you what to do. They just tell you it better be good enough, whatever that means. But what you're saying is you meet a bunch of standards. When you connect to another device, right? So for example, a heart monitor, that heart monitor might need updates, right? Mm-hmm. So do they get the updates through you or how do they get the updates?
So we don't work with devices unless the manufacturers have met the FDA requirements and standards. So all of the devices that we integrate with meet those requirements. What we're doing is really just ingesting the data and getting it into the electronic medical records and setting parameters or thresholds, whether they're high or low or don't come in, so that we can try and catch a chronic episode before it takes place.
So there's at least two parts to that. So the first one is you capture a lot of data. So you capture the data, presumably you associate it with the patient somehow, because the patient is the one that data applies to. So a heart rate for me that would hit the threshold would be a lot different from a heart rate from somebody else, right?
Yes.
The second thing you said is you do some analysis to predict something that might happen or be able to determine if something exceeded a threshold and then do some sort of alert. Is that correct?
Correct.
Can you just describe what sort of, you have a learning mechanism or AI, or what do you do, statistical analysis? What do you do to determine that something is worthy of note?
So we have pre-built rules that are built around best practices around every chronic disease that have certain thresholds and parameters that are standard guidelines and protocols. The doctors at the end of the day approve or confirm where they want these thresholds. They're a lot of times best practices. And then if the patient is above or below any of those parameters, we have machine learning, AI, where it sends reminders or it creates an alert that goes into the care dashboard so that we can then triage that patient and address the issue.
Okay, now you said two very different things there. You said basically you have a rule-based system. So the rule-based system, the physician says 100 beats per minute or more, warn me. That's not learning. That's a rule-based system, and the physician sets the rules. Now, you also said you have some sort of a learning system. Can you tell me about that? Or is that not the same thing?
I mean, the system has algorithms, rules engines, logic to when we ingest this information, there's pre-built rules around certain parameters or around certain data points that we can set these thresholds to.
Yeah, but that's a rule-based system, right? That's not learning. So do you have a learning system in there? And if so, what does it do and how does it do it?
I guess there wouldn't be. It'd be all pre-built rules then.
By the way, that's probably much safer. But you use rule-based systems, so you test it, it's reliable and so forth, and you hopefully you detect modifications to your software and keep it up to date and otherwise manage it on behalf of everybody. So great. So you're also looking for funding. How big is your company? You have hundreds or thousands or millions of patients today that are on the system or what?
There's thousands of patients using the technology, either through a SaaS offering or through a managed service contracting model.
SaaS is software as a service.
Software as a service or a managed services model.
That's patients. How many physicians or other medical providers are using the system?
Over 100 clinics that are using the system.
Are they part of a system of clinics or are these just independent clinics?
A lot of them are just independent clinics, and we are at the final stages of some very large opportunities with some large health systems. We've put together requests for information for them, and they're now going through the RFI process. So actively, there's hundreds of clinics, and we do have some large health systems in the pipeline as well.
Great. Well, so they can read more about your company if they're accredited investors and interested in investing in the opportunity that's there today by going to thecybershow.co. And you have a listing there that will be online starting this week.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Full of double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. Breakthroughs in scams and spams have enabled a new generation of liars to lie. Meanwhile, truthers are unable to get their pants on in time to chase the liars around the world. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. And that's breaking news on the Cyber Show.
Yeah, and the last part we were talking about, your path in all this and shipping systems and logistics and so forth. In my path, in 1981, 82, I got my first full-time job working in a printing plant, 16 years old, did that for six years. And there's all the Sears catalogs in Canada, right? So I got to watch and be part of watching the paper and the glue and the inks and the dyes and all of the things coming into the plant, being processed, going out of the plant in various other forms, right? And bills of material.
Right, the big rolls.
Oh yeah, yeah. Three-story presses, high speed, that were in the early half of the 1900s, the top of technology. The photo engraving, on big plates to do high speed printing with the biggest budget, Sears catalogs, which was the internet. As far as online shopping, that the Sears catalog was your go-to in all of North America. So I got to plug into the end of that. You plugged into shipping, right? And both of us, in your case, since I hadn't really been on the bulletin boards, I had done a little phone or learned a little phone hacking. It's like, oh, how do I get into this, you know, a code or whatever, you know, to do long distance calls. But it wasn't so much about security. It was about how does this system work? You know, how do I work with it? Mm-hmm. So you went from that into security. So how did that transition start, you know, in your career?
Well, the funny thing is I had a bunch of startups at the same time. So I started the first ISP in Charleston, took my bulletin board and actually built the first ISP in town. Did it with another ISP guy. I went off to a rainbow gathering, came back and he locked us out. We had to sue, get our money out. It was a really,
what year was that?
That was in 94.
Perfect.
So I learned very early on the mistakes of starting companies with people without having operating agreements. And I would only make that mistake one more time in my life. And that was because it was my brother. But that's a whole nother story, which we'll get into a whole nother conversation. But sure. From there, I started that ISP. And I actually was doing a wireless ISP a couple of years after that. I gotten some equipment from a German manufacturer out of Florida. It was actually, you know, like 20-mile range wireless transmission. I actually had videos of myself driving down Highway 17 playing Quake wirelessly. I kept going to like lawyer because of the people I worked for. I worked for, if you know anything about Charleston, it was, you know, it was the Maybank family, the Gibbs family. That I was very lucky with the people I worked for.
Right.
And then because of them, I had access to great lawyers and great people of the city of Charleston. Everybody I went to was like, why do I want internet, let alone wirelessly? Everybody. And right. I saw a friend of mine who I respect him greatly. He's a great friend, but honestly, I'm way more a geek. And he got a job in California, and I'm like, holy shit, makes that much money? And that's what prompted it. I was like, if he can do this, then I just need to get the hell out of Dodge and go where they respect technology. So I met, you know, I did a couple interviews, interviewed with Industrial Light and Magic, Wells Fargo, Citibank, and ended up at Wells Fargo actually writing policies. So I actually was in the policy department, which was a great shift because it got me in the very basis of a computer structure. You know, if you're writing policies, everything builds from that.
Yeah. Why are you doing things? The actual code is how you do them. Yeah.
Yep. And it was the nice thing is this team not just wrote the policies, but if you think about a modern agile development team where you have, you know, the proper balance of security and operations and your developers and your SREs all together building products. I actually consulted into the development of the team. So I worked mostly with the brokerage side of the company. And anytime they had a big project going on, I would be their security consultant to actually say, okay, the policies mean this. Here's how we have to, you know, I would tie the security story together around those policies to make sure they're following the right structure. So I was actually a consultant into the business unit to make that happen. So it was a combination of those two things. And that was what really began, you know, the beginning of my bigger side of my career.
Right. And this, you know, over the last year or two, you know, Richard Steenan, you know, started doing the security yearbook, you know, capturing history and, you know, with all these different podcasts and radio shows and so forth that I'm involved with, and I've seen others doing it. I think we have this amazing shared history that mm-hmm. literally is you and I have lived and our friends have lived the life you see in Hollywood, you know,
And
it involves a lot less being shot at. But not always. You know, there's a number of folks, you know, I'm not one of them, you know, who travel the world with serious security because nation states would like to kill them. But, you know, the interesting parts of it, you know, that really make the story, you know, a lot of it's serendipitous. You know, it keeps it fairly humble because if you or I had not gotten this job or that job, you wouldn't have gotten the experience that would lead to where you are right now. But you did.
Or made the connection that made this other thing happen over here. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. So at this point, you can look back and that, you know, I love policy hacking more than anything. You know, code is fascinating. However, right. Doesn't matter. Policy is everything. You understand the policies, you know, look at, you know, policies like with the boats, right. You mm-hmm. know, the you know, there's three layers to policy hacking. It's what are the policies? When was the last time they were changed? Why were they changed? As you start to understand that, you mentioned Charleston, right? You know, if you understand, you know, how these policies got into place and why the motivations of the stakeholders, then you understand everything. Everything after that is just details, right?
Assuming the policies are up to date.
Well, but they are what they are. You know, you know, the state may be that you can't fix this. You need to try somewhere else. But you know, it comes down to, you know, you work for VMware now and their policy is to hire people like you and give you the authority they did. That tells me a lot more than a code review, right?
Although, to be honest, I came in through an acquisition, so they hadn't... Yeah, they decided to retain me, which I'm very happy for. And I'm very optimistic that I'll be beneficial toward Broadcom as well as that moves forward. So I, in fact, I see my role as what I do is I'm really, I have what's called the field CISO role. And as I see that role as today is I am our customer's champion. So say I'm working with a bank. I know what their requirements are. I know how their I don't know their exact policies, but I know generally what their policies should be. So I can go back to our development teams. I can go to our sales teams and say, okay, here's how we sell to them. Here's how we talk to them. Here's what the different groups and screens need out of this. So I'm the advocate of the customer into VMware. And then also making sure that our products meet the needs of the customer. And I explain it to our customers. So I'll do a lot of workshops where I'll sit down and explain, okay, as you can imagine, you know, the products that I deal with is everything from Spring Boot development to the supply chain of like our application platform where actually builds applications to the build packs of all the different languages to the databases. We actually have, you know, GreenPlum and MySQL and commercial self, you know, database support all the way to the running Kubernetes clusters, to the management of the clusters, to the auditing of the clusters. It's like full. I mean, it's one thing to say you have like, I provide Kubernetes. It's nothing to say actually I provide Java, Spring Boot all the way through to the running of the operations. And now when you try and talk to a company about, well, what does that really mean? You know, going back to our SBOM conversation, each one of these is gather SBOMs. Each one of these has their order of orchestration, how it all ties together and what do you get out of it? It can be a multi-week conversation just to make sure we're all on the same page. Because as I said earlier, words are difficult sometimes.
Oh yeah. Well, they have very specific meanings. The whole identity issue for, you know, now more than 30 years for me, right? You know, from the day one when I knew nothing, I'm looking at it and saying, that looks really, really hard. I bet we're dealing with that forever. You know, to in the supply chain world now, you know, just naming, you know, so you're, you know, the name for a piece of software. Oh, somebody else bought that company. You know, they changed the name. How do we even know? Right. You know, so it's,
We change the name of our software every 2 years without any outside prompting. So
you talk about policy. It becomes more apparent as I see and hear more of this discussion that you're talking about enterprise policy, government policy, that sort of policy.
Why? Yes, the why.
That's not what I'm saying here. You talked about how the policy came to be. In the forensic space, I have a saying, tell people what you do in forensics. It starts, how did it come to be? How did it come to me? And what did I do with it? That's sort of the job description, right?
Yeah.
And so the how did it come to be part of policy is the thing you're talking about, but the policy itself is the thing that gets implemented. So what happens for many cases is that policy gets created and then people have to execute on it and they aren't necessarily privy to how it came to be. And in particular, this is part of the disconnect that we find in all of our assessments, right? So it's called everybody thinks that they know what's important because the policy or whatever mechanism they got trained about it tells them that this is the most important thing ever, the thing I'm working on. And it's never true. It might be true sometime, but it's a random selection. Yeah, and you go and you find out from executive management, their version of the elephant is, no, it's a big thing that lumbers down the street. And the person that's doing the technology says, no, it's all about the trunk, right? No, it's,
right.
So, but what hits me about this is this policy thing has to do with enterprises, government structures. It has to do with structured organizations. And individuals, people, and people in their lives don't have this formalized policy thing. What they have is something in their brain that tells them how to make decisions. And that's completely different. And I think when you say, keep talking about policy, you're talking about ultimately governance, which is not how most people run their lives.
Well, you know, and think about this in David's context as well, right? You know, so he goes, you know, from Florida to Silicon Valley, you know, get involved in it, get in a bank, you know, ends up doing security and policy, you know, sort of organically, like so many people of our era. And, you know, to your point about policy, there's, I think, two types of policy. There's the written policy, and then there's the actual policy. Right. You know, and that just made a Home Depot run. So in the shopping, it's, you know, Friday of Labor Day weekend, the shopping carts are almost impossible to find. So the policy, the written policy might be that, you know, employees will go out and, you know, retrieve the parking lot, the shopping carts from the parking lots every 10 minutes. Maybe that's the policy. I don't know that, but maybe that is the written policy. But you may find out at an individual store that the actual policy is nobody does that unless the supervisor's on site, which only happens every second Saturday. The rest of the time they do it based on ad hoc decisions of the individuals, whatever, you know, the case may be. So when I say policy, I really just do mean the why. And I specifically break that down into the written policy, the policy you think is the policy because someone wrote it down. And then there's the policy about how things are actually done, which is quite often not written down. But, you know, time and motion studies and various other things will show this over and over again, that things are actually done this way. And in both cases, you can take that three-stage policy thing, what is the policy, when did it become like that and why, right? So a de facto policy, you may not even know exists until you observe it. And if you look back at it and say, that started when the idiots at corporate sent us this written policy that absolutely didn't work and we lost a third of our staff, right? And then,
you're talking about implementation of policy. Let's be careful here. So we decided to implement the policy of every 5 minutes you have to go out and take care of the carts by not doing that.
Right.
but technically, we followed the policy. We just implemented it in a different way.
Right.
There's another thing that strikes me, and that is in cyber, there's this policy, this governance document created by, the people in charge, which is the governance aspect of it, not government. There is governance in government, but in every company, there's governance by their leadership. But then there's something called technical security policy. And the technical security policy, that's the technical decision-making processes. And, typically it's codified in some procedures and so forth about how you do stuff. And there's a disconnect between those two policies and between those two terms. And people in the technical space think policy is, the settings on read or write or, on files or something like that. And people in the government governance structure, their view of policy is, what does that have to do with that? And so what you get is these weird disconnects, like it's something that says you'll only do authorized activities. And what they mean is something your boss said you could do because you asked or because they told you. And then you have people at the technical level that say you can only do authorized activities. Oh, that means that the bit was set to authorize you in a file.
Yeah.
And so then what happens is somebody breaks into the system. The person breaking into the system, and I don't mean necessarily a threat actor from outside, I mean, somebody modifying some setting somewhere by accident or on purpose changes the technical setting, which is interpreted as a change in the technical policy by the technical mechanisms, even though the policy hasn't changed at all.
Well, everywhere I look, I see incomplete stacks, right? Which is usually just fine, because, a truly complete stack of anything, you start to get into quantum foam and so forth when you stop. But it worked well enough to date, generally speaking. But intellectual property control is just, the canary in the coal mine to me. I've seen this twice, the emergence of threat intelligence, now the emergence of supply chain intelligence, when you have people inside companies saying, oh my God, our intellectual property is at risk. And I spent a lot of time talking through that and, helping develop mechanisms to protect that. But if you stop and step back and say, how are you doing intellectual property control now? What you find out is that, somewhere deep in a big corporation, a lawyer somewhere wrote a document and then hired a lot of people. And maybe they, clicked on some training that said they read the document. Maybe they actually read it. Who knows? But it's not clear on their day-to-day. They're going through, you're handling all sorts of intellectual property all the time and making moment-by-moment personal judgments on whether or not saying it a certain way is sharing that information or not. So intellectual property control is something that scares corporations, scares people with legal responsibilities, legal risks. But, if you're functioning today, doing it the way you're doing it right now, you probably can't do it worse.
Well, one of the things I do besides recording the show with you is to actually listen to the show. So I have to edit it later on. And I've been hearing you talk a lot about this lately, about the lack of meat on the bones of intellectual property protection. And having paid attention to it, I've come to the conclusion, first of all, that you're completely right. Not only is there lack of meat on the bones, but actually it all just is about trusting people.
Right, right. Yeah. Which actually works okay.
How do we know we're being successful at the cyber show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Roger Royce is one of the most well-known and well-positioned attorneys working on cyber issues, particularly in the ag tech arena, but also in many other areas. He also has a tremendous understanding of influence and related issues, as we'll see in our discussions.
There's more investment in companies that are successfully selling something than these sort of notional things. Oh, I'll invest in a company that might be big because they have a good idea, but they don't have a product on the market yet.
Yeah, well, traction is really important, even in ag tech. And by the way, yeah, venture is way down. You know, it's been a bit of a desert. But ag tech, you know, is down less than other sectors. It's still a pretty, it's still, what's the right word for it? It's still pretty attractive in terms of that particular vertical. And, but you hit a good point. Traction is super important.
So that word traction has always bothered me, because if you're talking about sales, say sales, mostly when people say traction, when I start to ask them, what it means is, well, people have expressed interest, or we have some free demos out there, or you know, these kinds of things, which are not sales, right? Until somebody hands you money in exchange for something, you haven't demonstrated anything of significance to me.
No, well, I'm glad you figured that out, because that's right. Because you see a lot of products, people will come in and say, oh, we got traction. We got all these farmers using our product. But you got to ask the next question. Are they paying you for it? You know, can you show that someone will actually pay you for this? Because that's what, you know, we want to see. We want to know you can sell one. Because if you can sell one, maybe you can sell 10. If you can sell 10, maybe you can sell 10,000. So it's important to be able to show you got consumer acceptance.
Yeah. And then there's what I'll call projections, which people only give you one number for their projections over time. And, you know, we have our own cash flow analysis software, and it always has ranges of projections, right? So you say, I'm going to, you know, it's going to cost this much each, and I'm going to sell this many of them, and it's going to take this long to happen. Okay, that's the midline. Now, what's the lower end, realistically, you know, that's based on you didn't quite make the sales, and how many of them will really respond to that email and so forth? And then what's the best case? Not the ridiculous case, but the best case. And we look at those future envelopes as better predictors. The other thing is, when you do it that way, as you make progress, you can update the sales sieves, update these projections in real time, and figure out when things are not going as well as they should be, so you can adapt before you find out 4, 5, 6 months later that you didn't make enough sales.
Yeah.
So I find a lack of, I'll call it, expertise and willingness to spend the time and effort to get that stuff right and analyze it.
Yeah, and I want to pause on this for a minute and take even a bigger step back, because you're assuming quite a bit of sophistication, I think, for my typical startup companies to do that.
Yeah, I'm demanding a level of sophistication before I'll put money into it.
Well, there you go, and you should. I think we've seen recently with some of the big, huge fraud cases that are going on and failures, that there are even very big sophisticated investors who did not diligence that as much as you would have thought, or they diligenced it and weren't getting they weren't getting true answers. Let me put it that way.
Well, so part of what constitutes due diligence, as you're well aware as an attorney, is applying appropriate expertise in the context of the situation. And if you're investing $5,000 in a company that you expect in 5 years will make its first sale, the level of diligence is far less than if you're, you know, putting $50 million into a company that claims to be worth $500 million and claims to have all this money in sales. I mean, so the level of diligence, the expertise you need to apply, is a function of the situation. And there's two phenomena here. One of them is, I don't think they do that diligence for the larger amounts of money for the big players. And the other one is, there's this following behavior. They tend to trust each other. So when one of them invests, you get a lead investor in that class, all the other investors will jump in and not do diligence on it.
Yeah.
The diligence they will do will be nominal. So they tend to trust each other unnecessarily and inappropriately.
Right. And then they have to have the expertise to actually do the diligence. And we found in ag tech, you know, there's not, you know, not all investors understand agriculture and they don't ask the right questions. So, but the bigger issue, you know, on the news this morning, I heard a investigative report that there is a disproportionate percentage of 30 under 30 award winners who are frauds, who are sitting in prison, you know, or been convicted of something.
Or should be.
Yeah. And it's always security fraud. It's always that they've misrepresented something when they're out selling their stock because they're so overly optimistic. And one of the things I do as a lawyer is try to make sure people don't cross that line between puffing and fraud, right? I mean, we've seen some very high-level trials here lately where people crossed the line and they had to pay for it. So,
well, even puffing is a little bit much for me, right? One of my key determiners in whether I'll invest is honesty. And if you're lying to me, you know, I'm just walking away.
Yeah.
You know, I've foolishly engaged with people who lie to me and you know, run the consequences, but I understand the risks that I take, right? So I'm investing in situations where that's not too harmful to me.
Right. But, and what I tell people is, you know, with security sales, it's seller beware, not buyer beware, seller beware. You better be upfront. You better tell your investors everything you think they might want to know, because this could really come back and hurt you.
Well, people walk away from contracts. People have signed agreements that they just walk away from, or they create fantasies. Their lawyers, maybe with information from the principals that is not very good, will jump to conclusions and just misrepresent things and so on and so forth. And lawyers have a responsibility for diligence too, right?
Well, to a degree, yeah, to an extent. I mean, all I can do is advise, right? It's kind of what you said earlier. I can't. You know, I can't force people to take action. I can just advise them on what. See, lawyers can't tell you what will happen. They can only tell you what might happen.
Well, they can tell you what has happened.
Oh, you know, there you go. What has happened. Yeah.
And despite the claim in the investment world that future returns are, you know, somehow not related to historical returns, the truth is, you know, fraudsters historically continue to be fraudsters.
Yeah, well, fortunately, I don't see that very often. That's a minority of the cases. I read about it in the papers more often than not. But those are cautionary tales for all entrepreneurs. Be super careful when you're selling securities because it's so easy now. People can go online, they can download some form that they found on some popular website that's probably not very company favorable, by the way, but they downloaded it. Then they go, they're off and running selling securities without even thinking about compliance. It's easy to do in the internet age.
Anyway, they're selling securities without doing any of the necessary. So what is the PPMs, private placement memoranda, have been largely replaced by these safe notes and other similar ridiculous instruments that are modified in many cases. So the investor, you know, if it's successful, the company can buy it back from the investor at some small interest rate, instead of the investor getting the big win. But if it goes bad, the investor loses it all. So people don't seem to read these contracts. They seem to think that because they are legal looking, that we're just going to do it. On the other hand, when you're investing $5,000 or $10,000 into a startup, how much time and effort can you reasonably put in? And so it begins, we start to talk about the idea of diligence and the lack of being diligent.
And I guess the flip side of that is, I mean, you're talking about trust. One of the things I love about the security industry, the cybersecurity industry, and I love about uncorrupted business environments is they tend to self-filter for trust. I mean, you know, you can be a weasel and maybe that works, but it, you know, you end up in an isolated bubble. In a corrupted system, of course, it can work very, very well and be a great path to personal riches. But, you know, in the professional world you and I live in, if you are really truly untrustworthy, you're not in this network of folks that you and I know and all our peers and so forth. And it is the entire set of the best security people on earth. Because you can't get into there, you can't stay there for very long if you're a lying weasel in business environments. And you know, it's more in turning around from our community and dealing with the organizations we serve, the enterprises, the public, private organizations out there. It is, as you say, it's sort of interesting. It's like, all right, you realize that this is a business and it's bounded by like documents and you signed them. Did you read them? Did you sort of think about the consequences of that clause right there that says actually you're responsible for everything? So yeah, I can encrypt your email, but it doesn't really matter because you know you have fundamental problems.
It's interesting that you talk about reading these things because I've been in the process, you know, we're starting one new cybersecurity company a month this year is our goal, and we have some funding behind it. And so I'm in the process of reading the documents to start starting these companies. And, you know, back and forth with the lawyers and comments, and then go to the investors and get their comments and back and forth. It's really hard to believe that anybody will read these documents other than me.
Right.
I'm pretty much convinced they just won't. And they should. You know, I tell people they should. I believe they should. But they don't. Another thing is people seem to want to sign things so soon. You know, I'm like, no, no. So when I do a lot of these contracts with people, and, you know, I do a fair number of these using my sort of standard contracts, what I commonly do is I read it to them, you know, in front of them online, right? So we're both there, and I walk through every line and make sure that they understand my understanding of it, right? And I tell them I'm not a lawyer, so, you know, you need to get yours. But the idea here is to just to make sure they actually understand what we're saying in those agreements.
Well, again, as I said in a call, you know, as recently as just now, before this, you know, one of the reasons I love working with you, and I think, you know, talking about the ag in the previous segment we're recording, look, it's easy to be smart, you know, and there's a lot of smart people, and it's easy to say, hey, that will work, you know, but, you know, I have a burden on smart folks that I sort of require, but you're smart enough to realize that, yeah, that, you know, your brilliant technical idea is actually governed. The money part of it is governed by that contract you just signed without reading it. You're smart enough to know that, I mean, you found out that this line of code plus this, this, and this motor over here will make a thing, and you didn't read through the if this, then that of surrounding its ownership. You know, so, but, you know, also it is, and you said, you're right, most people won't read it. It's a burden of time we don't want to go through. I think people want to sign it really quickly because partly they're hoping nobody notices that they're not reading it, right? It's like, because we all feel a little guilty. It's like an end user license agreement. You're literally, you know, how many pages are there in an Apple iPhone, you know, these things you have to scroll through before it lets you install?
No, it's not just that you have to scroll through the 40 or 50 pages worth of stuff that's right there in the agreement. It also references a right. whole lot of other stuff that's, you know, a million pages, right?
Yeah, we all care. We all have this frustration, guilt, everything else. But it's like, I know I'm doing this. But to our point here, people will bring that into the corporate world. And you have to, I stop myself by, you know, working with people like you. You know, I have been through that process back and forth with lawyers myself. I know how it works. I also know that I will tend to try to skip over it. So if you're running a business or you're building a security platform, or you're building a cyber, you know, as we're talking about in this show, don't let yourself forget, right, that there's some resource that needs to be put to that. Maybe you don't want to do it. Get somebody who will. You know, let them stop you and say, I know you'd like to go for it, but listen, you have to look at this clause. Otherwise, just sign it and don't think about it, and maybe it works out, because nothing short of that is going to help. Can't skip a line, right? Not one line. Yeah.
Well, so when you say that, so, you know, you've read it three or four times now, and you're going to read it yet again, every word of it and so forth, right? So I sometimes miss a few words from the paragraph that I already know what it says, but, you know, they could try to fool me, but I'm dealing with my own lawyers here. So
right.
That's the other thing. You know, lawyers can be quite expensive, and good lawyers are even more expensive. So when you're investing $5,000, you know, you really can't afford to spend 10 or 20 on a lawyer to go over it with you back and forth. And the other thing is, a lot of these agreements, you know, they're set because other people have agreed to them. You can't really change them.
Right.
But you have to decide yes or no. So, you know, that's problematic. And then I noticed that contracts have a tendency to keep getting longer. And it's because the lawyers encounter more and more of case law and new laws and so forth. And they say, well, we've seen this go wrong. So we're going to add a clause that says, if this happens, you can't do that. But if that happens, you can do this. And then there is sort of just the desire for different people to have control over things, right? So I have my intellectual property involved in new companies we're creating. And it's not even so much about the money. I shouldn't say this on the air. Oh, my goodness. Everybody knows now. It's not so much about the money as about, so if it's my written works, I don't want other people to change what they say and attribute them to me. What I want them to do is say, here's the person who came up with this original. Here's a copy of it. Here's our spin on it. But in business, you don't get to do that because the technical documents turn into marketing documents. And the marketing documents have to be effective at communicating and convincing the audience of something. So when you get that person who knows what's actually real and the marketing person who's writing something to try even, you know, accurately reflect what's actually real to that potential customer, the problem comes in that they don't know what the inventor, what the engineer, what the scientist knows. And the scientist doesn't understand the psychological aspects or how people might interpret things. So getting those translators in the middle turns out to be a lot of the issue. And one of the things about a good lawyer, having seen, you know, actual cases back and forth, they see these different perspectives and they are, by the nature of what they do, translating between those spaces. And then, of course, they're writing the legal language because they believe that to be precise. And, you know, there's no limit. What is it? The Ferengi on Star Trek? You know, they have these contracts that are enormously voluminous. And, you know, because they're trying to specify everything down to the niche. So I should tell you this. I had a discussion with Roger Royce, who is also, so everybody knows, full disclosure, he's my lawyer at Angel Eggs. And we have discussions about uncertainty in agreements. And I keep telling him, boy, you keep wanting to specify everything that can happen. And I want to not specify some of that stuff.
Right.
No, I want it clear. No, I would like a little bit less clear.
Yeah.
So, you know, why do I want it unclear and he wants it clear? Well, he's doing his job to make sure that the meeting of the minds is as legally clear as he can make it. And I actually think that the meeting of the minds is not that clear, that we don't actually know all that stuff.
Right.
And so we should be saying it that way. We should be saying, you know, something to the effect of, well, you know, we'll reasonably agree to this stuff later.
Well, right. You know, it's, you know, I look at it, you know, everything I sign and so forth, you know, I put my gauge how much time I'm going to put into it by how much risk I think there is in what I'm doing. And most of that decision is based on who I'm dealing with. You know, what are the odds that this person, this entity is the kind that would actually, you know, intentionally put something bad in there, you know, to cause me harm. And it's usually pretty low because I would tend not to deal with people I felt that way about anyways. And that works pretty well. And my one example in my professional life is did a high-tech, you know, security startup in the early 2000s in Silicon Valley. And we got the very best, most expensive Silicon Valley startup lawyers to give us all, create all our draft contracts. And I had to get all the partnerships together and get all that. And it was back and forth. You know, the first customer, first partner, who, you know, somebody brings to their lawyers, they add some clauses. And they're good clauses. It's like, yeah, actually, that's totally right. You know, if that happened, you all want to make sure that's not your, you know, I'll sign off on that. And we all sign and everybody goes along happy. And then the next one, their lawyers add in a couple of clauses too. And those are good clauses too. Like, I could make, yep, that makes sense. You know, if that happens, you know, it's not your fault. We'll take that. And. Every single time you get in that engagement, there's more clauses. Which means that up to the last version, assuming that one actually finally covered all the contingencies, every other one didn't, right?
Well, you know, and I guarantee you it didn't cover all the contingencies. Over the period, not now, but also not over the period of the contract, because laws and case law changes. So right. You know, every time there's a decision by your local court, it potentially changes it. And as you go up the court structure, you know, the Supreme Court makes a decision, and man, you have, you know, 100,000 or more contracts that now have a clause that's no longer valid. So, which is why they all have the clause that says if anything here should be found invalid by a court of competent jurisdiction, everything else remains in force. And then they take the belt and suspenders approach where they say, notwithstanding whether clause 5B actually is held to be right, we still want to say this in some other way. I wish it was not so, but I think it has to be because that's how people are.
Tuesday, July 18th, go to Angel, present your company, get on the show and make a fortune or not. For more details or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking here with Jennifer Bayuk. Jennifer was one of the first chief information security officers on Wall Street and has a long and storied career before and after that.
You're doing consulting, then what happened?
So through a recruiter, I heard about a position at Citigroup. They wanted to create a cybersecurity risk management department in the second line of defense, which meant reporting to the chief risk officer, not to IT.
Oh, I love it.
And I went to the interview to try to sell them on a consulting project for me to get that started. We want a full-time employee to do this. We don't want a consultant to do this. So I broke down and went to Citigroup as an employee to create this department.
Yeah. When you say broke down, your consulting fees were great, but this pay was in the range of where those consulting fees
were,
right?
Yes, I managed to get them to cover the consulting fees for being a
It was called 40 hours a week of that high consulting rate. That you need because you're spending your time selling the consulting, right?
Well, also, though, you know, to be fair, when you work at Citigroup, it's not a 40-hour a week, and it is closer to 80 hours a week, and it is global. And I was trotting off to India and Singapore and, you know, Philippines and, you know, places that I wouldn't go on vacation.
But it was fun and interesting.
Yes, yes, it was. And never a dull moment. I mean, just the people I met were amazing. So many smart people all over the world and working in risk management, and all of them completely frustrated about cybersecurity risk. So everybody was on my team.
So did you alleviate all the frustration, solved all the problems?
Yeah. Well, I at least created a framework that was systematic and could be executed by the risk officers who were already in a technology risk management role. They knew that they needed technology risk management in the first line. They didn't have it in the second line. So I created this second line framework that gave them support in achieving their goals.
So they could do measurement and surveillance and understand numerically, mathematically, what the potential negative consequences were associated with different decisions.
Well, that is the aim. Not everybody gets there, but they do have a justification for keeping their work to an industry standard level and auditable and you know, just having a really good basis for deciding what needs to be remediated and what doesn't.
Yeah. So this is fundamental, right? This decision-making process about what to do and what not to do, because there's a very large set of different things you can do in different circumstances. And if you try to do it all, then you will put yourself out of business by spending too much money on security.
Right.
And if you do none of it, you'll put yourself out of business because you'll get wiped out by the bad guys. So there's this you lose if you do everything, there you lose if you do nothing. And the question is, where in the middle do you settle with whatever losses are then left?
Exactly. And you know, keeping losses down, that's all operational risk does. So it fit very well into the operational risk framework.
So let's talk for a moment about that, because there's something else that it does, at least people claim that it does, and I believe it does. And that is, because of that decision-making process, risk avoidance is what you do when you don't seem to have any other alternative, because you know, you're always taking risks for rewards in business. That's why you do all these things. And so really the issue is that what risks can you take? And there's an enabling function of taking risks you otherwise could not take. That is, making bets you couldn't otherwise make because you have a good structure that's measurable and you can have defined limits on losses and so forth.
Yeah, there were days, you know, when people didn't put up an internet website because of the risks, right? Now they do it without thinking, because there's a little bit more stability around e-commerce than there was.
But it's an enabling function.
Yes, security is enabling.
That's right. So this other view of it, where it's always saying no, you know, that's one of the big problems we have with security. And another big problem is they seem to forget about the user, right? They say, oh, that's all right. We'll just make it take 18 more steps to send each email, right? And, you know, us users are like, I push send, now I have to say authorize it. It's too many, not enough sends. I have to put my watch out. I need to give an iPrint. Okay, can I finally send the email? No, because the time expired since when you first said send the email, because we put all these other restrictions on you. So at some point, you know, the security breaks the system. And that's what we seem to be facing a lot of now, because of the consequences largely of influence operations at this point.
Yeah.
Systems are breaking down because people are over securing them or haven't found the right combination of things. So what do you do to help solve that problem?
I tried to bring a very common sense approach to those problems. You're reminding me of an incident where I was asked to go to the office of a private client organization, you know, wealth management type organization. And they were told by their IT team that they were not allowed to take orders over the phone because somebody could impersonate their client and call up and claim to be the client.
Which they can do.
Which they can do. And I said, well, how well do you know your clients? Right? Do you recognize their voice? If you talked about something that happened 6 years ago, would they say yes? What can you talk to them about that would give you assurance that this is the person that you really know? Because these people in the private wealth, they visit their clients 4 times a year in person. They're required to, you know, they know who these people are. To say that you would rather trust somebody logging into a computer and making an order than that relationship with that person was patently absurd. You have to just use common sense, and it's different for every business. And what you can say is that if the relationship manager for that client is unavailable, then you need to pull out a second form of authentication, something that you have given them for that emergency day when their broker isn't around to verify who they are. So, you know, that type of thing is what you would do in the different areas with different requirements for security.
Yeah, so it has to be fit to purpose. Mm-hmm. That's fundamental. And there's no single defined pattern, but there are some pretty common patterns, right? So that particular pattern would apply to all sorts of wealth management sort of situations. But those templates for your own wealth management, here's a set of things to do, they largely don't exist. Is that right?
I don't want to speak for everyone, but I didn't see a whole lot of them.
I mean, writ large, right? That is, in the industry, we haven't figured out those patterns and published
them. Right.
Now, we do have our standards of practice, which are intended to approach that. Mm-hmm. And as we exercise them more and more, they become more and more customized and verticalized. Yes. But at the end of the day, you have to have enough of those done, and you have to evolve them over time. And it becomes burdensome, but less burdensome than the losses if you don't do it well, and then the cost of everybody doing it themselves. So is there some future path that you see where we have, well, let's say we work together to find good ways to do these things and adapt them over time in the vertical niches for all the niches that are sufficiently large to be worthwhile? Is that something we're going to do in security, or is that just pipe dream?
I believe that the regulators have gone down that path, and the places, the networks like SWIFT and Visa, they've gone down that path. They're actually a little bit more successful because they do have technology that is the same in a bunch of different areas. So they can control more. You know, the industry standards that we have are just that, industry standards. And regulatory standards are much more specific to the industry, which is why the technology industry needs some, right? Because they don't have any. They just use whatever other industry standards seem to be, you know, working for them. But I might sound a little like I'm preaching sometimes, but I do preach. You must develop your own enterprise standards. You cannot say I'm an ISO shop and leave it at that, because that means you haven't thought things through on how your business works.
Does she sound like a woman after your own heart?
Oh, so much in there, right? Yeah. The example she was talking about reminded me of one that you and I use notionally, you know, all the time talking about it, with the Pathfinder sort of thing, right? Yeah, you know, it's like, you know your clients. What do you mean you can't take an order over the phone? So you're going to have, you know, what kind of organization are you? You know, we have 200 clients. You know, we work with them individually very closely. All right, you're going to have them calling up on the phone and just say no to them? No, you're not. Figure it out. Holy cow.
So one of the things she said is common sense. And in my experience, common sense is not all that common.
Right.
And so the big problem with taking a common sense approach is that there is no such thing as common sense. What there is, in my view, is expertise, actual people who actually know what they're doing. And that goes to the reasonable and prudent issue, right? The definition of reasonable and prudent involves having people that have the experience and the expertise in the field who are looking at it in light and in context of history and in the context of the particular situation and making judgments. And you would like it that if there was a body of people with that level of knowledge and experience and expertise and so forth, they would agree on that. But of course, they don't. You know, you and I talk all the time, and we agree on probably 99%+ of everything. but the only thing we talk about is the stuff we disagree about.
Right.
There's a reason, because there's no information in saying the things we already agree about.
Right.
It looks from the outside like there's no consensus, but in fact, there's a great deal of consensus between us and Jennifer, right? Who clearly sees the same things we've seen. And I think it has to do with the level of experience. I hate to say it. When I was young, I thought I knew everything, and now I know more.
You know, security, we talk cybersecurity and everything else, but security is literally security, safety and everything else. And over the last, about two and a half weeks, I have sailed two experimental boats, 300 kilometers, been through at least half a dozen serious storm events. One of them went sort of badly because, you know, I didn't have certain things installed, didn't do things certain ways. But I accept those risks all the bloody time, right? I am a very safe sailor, right? You know, I'm not dying on the water, you know, take my word for this. But there's a million things I don't do because I just don't have time. These are experimental boats. I'm not waxing not doing everything, you know, as you say, to a security perspective. Right. What's right? I don't know. Everything's contextual. Now, I wouldn't recommend anybody else do this, but I have the experience and expertise. I know exactly what I'm doing. I accept the risks that I live with every day, but I'm still here 3,000 miles later.
Yeah. Reasonable and prudent, right? What's unreasonable is doing things excessive. What's imprudent is not doing the basic things that you need to do in context. And as the person in charge, the CEO of a company, or, you know, your life is the one that's at stake, it's your judgment that makes the decision because you're the one that suffers the consequence.
Exactly. You know, what's right is what you decided. You know, and judging and judgment, right? These can carry a lot of negative connotations, you know, in the modern world, but this is, you know, you said you literally do it all the time. You make a judgment. Can I walk across the street? It's up to you. You have to make that executive decision at the moment, and nothing in cyber and nothing in systems is ever going to change that.
Which brings us to the Darwin Awards.
Yep. Well earned. And God bless humanity. You know, we're always pushing the envelope and doing things. I wonder what happens if you put all these helium balloons on a wall.
What would happen if I really did the thing where I tie myself to a buzzsaw and lay down and turn the thing on? Will somebody come and save me?
Right. Well, I think this is apocryphal. Yes, but I like the jet engine in the back of the El Camino, you know, in the salt flats to rises off the ground. Right.
Yeah, well, and, you know, they're trying to go faster and faster, but that's maybe didn't quite go to Stevens Institute of Technology and get the engineering skills there. Just saying.
Sorry, I got to mention, she mentioned the America's Cup. You know, in my lifetime, this has gone from a standard, you know, racing boat to what we have today. These hybrid monstrosity, 70-mile-an-hour parafoil catamarans. You know, that's an amazing example, again, of the advancement in innovation. For 100, more than 100 years. It was a standard race. It was beautiful boats. New Zealand said, you know, if we build one look like an aircraft carrier, we can get a bunch of people to sit on the outside and go faster. And it's evolved from there rapidly.
Competition plus technology advancement. They work hand in hand to motivate people to do better. And it's fantastic the way the world is evolving now. I mean, there's all sorts of areas that are making tremendous progress from not just from when we were young, but also from, like, you know, last month.
Right.
Yeah,
it really is really is amazing in fast advancing world.
It is. And I like your discussion point from one of our previous discussions where you talked about the fact that humanity has only been here for a relatively short period of time. There's a long way to go.
Right.
And where we are now is just like an inch in the kilometers of the lifespan of human beings if we don't wipe ourselves out. In terms of our development of ourselves, our technology, our knowledge, and everything else.
Right. And you know, put away for a second your hesitations about humanity and our faults and whatnot. If indeed there's intelligent life exists in the universe, it'll be, you know, here or somewhere else, you know, somebody from the outside looking in, should be able to sustain itself for millions of years, maybe billions. You know, we think about this with other species and other planets and other places all the time. If that's true, then this could be one of them. And literally millions of years from now, people could be looking back at us now and saying, oh my God, that was, you know, a couple hundred thousand years after the genes settled in, 50, 60,000 years after grandparents showed up and you could pass down stories, you know, long term, a couple thousand years, you know, 10, 20, you know, since basically writing things down and so forth happen right at the beginning.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on the Cyber Show, the pitch gets a bit sticky and the umpire might call a foul. Dave builds the chain and looks for the weak link. Roger makes music out of instruments. Jennifer wins in a competitive world. More fraud, spies, and lies, and a whole lot more. Only on the Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time and foul. A good time and foul. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and foul.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.